Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, I meet the young men behind The Scouting Book for Boys, the English coastal caravan romance with a dark twist. And I speak to British documentarist Andrew Lang about his debut film Sons of Cuba, following three young boxing hopefuls in Havana. And Zan Brooks joins me to review some of the week's other new releases, including Ecodoc, Dirty Oil, and I Love You, Philip Morris, starring Jim Carrey and Ewan McGregor. And we've a video nasty competition for you too. It's richer than a Mendes Winslet divorce lawyer. It's Film Weekly. Written by Jack Thorne of Skins and Shameless fame, The Scouting Book for Boys is the feature debut from director Tom Harper. It stars Thomas Turgoose, known for his roles in This Is England and Summer's Town, and was shot in Norfolk and Suffolk. Childhood friends David and Emily have a carefree, if basic, life growing up on a coastal caravan park. But when Emily thinks of escaping, David's romantic world is shattered until he's forced to take drastic action to keep things as they were.
If anyone sees Emily about or finds out anything, could they report it to the number? Because she's my friend and I want her back.
How long have you known her, son?
About 6 years. Both of our parents wake up on the sighting. Because we're the same age, and there ain't many more kids around permanent, we just sort of fell in. And now we're just trying to spend all our time together.
The film received its UK premiere at the London Film Festival, where I saw it first, and where writer Jack Thorne won the Best British Newcomer Award for his screenplay. And I'm delighted to say that Jack and director Tom join me in the Film Weekly studio now. So congratulations, Jack, to you on that LFF Award.
Thank you very much indeed.
And congratulations to you, Tom, as well, because this is your feature debut, but I've had my eye on you since I saw one of your shorts, Cubs, which also won awards. That had Ashley Waters in it, and it was about sort of urban fox hunting. Which I thought was a really good idea.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, sort of just kind of took that premise of fox hunting and put it into the context of a London nocturnal setting with kind of working class kids as opposed to upper class hunters.
Yeah, and that did really well for you. I mean, did the success of that short lead to the feature day? Because I know we've got a lot of listeners who kind of work in that. And I still think that working in shorts is a very good kind of grounding.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it certainly was kind of it enabled me to kind of work professionally as a director. And even though it didn't directly lead to the feature, it was one of a series of events that kind of eventually led to getting the feature off the ground. Because we did a scheme called Coming Up for Channel 4, which is focused on emerging talent. And I read a script of Jack's for that I wanted to direct but didn't get to. But I kind of really liked his writing. And so I think I called you up and said, could we go for a cup of coffee and see how we get on? And we liked each other. And then he was working with Ivana McKinnon, the producer, and it kind of came on from there.
What was it about the script that attracted you? Because the film's opening, I mean, I loved that opening. I thought it was exciting, it was cinematic, it was fresh, it was very British, but it had a new perspective. But it's very, as I say, cinematic. Was that on the page? Did Jack write that beginning on top of the caravan?
Yeah, well, Jack writes a lot of things in his scripts like, it's dawn, and you're like, you bastard, like that's like, it's really like one two words,
but over
it's like
to
a
you,
nightmare to kind of, because that golden hour is only for an hour, and if you've got a whole scene set at dawn, it's just a nightmare. So yeah, I think if you look at the beginning, the beginning scenes of Scouting Book for Boys is all kind of set at that magic hour in the morning, and the sun's just, but actually if you track it closely, you can see the sun jumping around all over the place.
So it's like because, different days.
Yeah,
he
different days, different times. Yeah, exactly.
It was beautiful because you and your cinematographer, Robbie Ryan, must have worked on getting that light, because it is very romantic. It's kind of lush. And I suppose that was to set up the story that is a romance, but then it has it gets progressively darker as it goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I worked with Robbie Ryan on Cubs as well, actually, and kind of that kind of developed from there. But yes, we really wanted it to be a sort of magical world, because as David and Emily, the lead characters, see the world, they want to keep it as things are. And in order for us to see how they don't want things to change, we had to see the world through their eyes, which is kind of the approach I've taken to the whole film, really. We see sort of everything from David's eyes. And so when life is perfect from at the beginning and everything is as he wants it, I wanted to see the beauty of his world, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And Jack, it's one of those stories that sort of twists. So you don't quite know where it's going to go. You know something's going to happen. There's a bit of dread. As a scriptwriter, how do you build that? Do you kind of concentrate on your characters? Is that the most important thing for you? And then the story will tell itself?
Well, with this, it was slightly different because I sort of knew the story, where I wanted the story to go from the beginning. So it was kind of, I always sort of knew that that's sort of the area I was aiming for and was just trying to kind of get there.
Are you a taught scriptwriter? Did you follow any kind of rules? Did you read any books? Did you go on any courses?
I didn't do any courses. I come from theatre. So I did a lot of like the Young Writers Programme at the Royal Court and those kind of things. So I suppose I was taught in that sense, but no screenwriting courses.
Ever since Skins, I thought, which was kind of watermark, watershed, it's kind of, it kind of changed youth television in a really great, not in an aggressive way, but in a very exciting and fresh way. What was your involvement with that? How were you there from the start?
Yeah, right at the start. Jamie and Brian created it. And then I was the first writer involved after that. So right at the start, it was the three quite seriously geeky people writing a TV show about cool kids. And so kind of sitting there going, yeah, so this would happen. Yeah, he'd definitely sleep with her. And you're like, well, yeah, we wouldn't. But you know what I mean? Like, he would because he's attractive and exciting. And it was kind of, so that was right at the beginning, yeah.
And was there a sort of sense that you wanted to push an envelope, or was that just it just happened? It was time that, people actually saw what young people these days got up to.
Brian's original pitch, Brian Elsley, he wanted to do a post-watershed teen show, and that it was literally as simple as that. And then he went into the things he didn't want it to be and the things that he wanted it to be. But I think that was sort of the really original sort of premise for it, that there hadn't actually been a post-watershed teen show. And then it sort of all grew from there, and Brian gave us as writers quite a lot of space to do our thing, that if we wanted to go to dark places, he kind of let us, and he let each episode be quite heavily authored, which I think was also quite original for that kind of thing.
It sounded great. The lines were great, but also the themes were good. There's sex and there's drugs and there's anorexia, there's death, there's kind of all this stuff that you think, well, of course that's what teens go through. But you've never really seen it other than sort of a bit in EastEnders or maybe a bit of Grange Hill when it was kind of, remember Zamo going through that?
Yeah, I do, Just Say No. Yeah.
Exactly. Can't believe it had been so long since anyone really kind of addressed that.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is I think films are slightly, had always been ahead of it. And do you know what I mean? I think American Pie is quite romantic.
Films, less so in British films. Perhaps.
Yeah, less so in British films. Yeah.
And is that, we're talking about things that you're going to sort of nick, the vibe of American films, which have long had a teen kind of generation. Normally the teenagers are played by like 35-year-olds. Like John Travolta in Greece or something.
We had a thing at the beginning of each meeting, we'd watch an episode of a teen show, and I'm a huge Dawson's Creek fan, so I made them sit there and watch Dawson's Creek, and they all just laughed all the way through every other writer, and I was gutted because I loved that show.
But they were all so drippy. She never did anything. Katie Holmes.
But yeah.
Weren't you upset?
Joey and Dawson, man. It's all about Joey and Dawson.
It's all about that. Will they, won't they?
Exactly.
Won't. They never do. Tom, were you similarly interested in youth culture? I mean, other than just being young oneself, that's the research one needs. You go with what you know if you're doing early films and early work.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think it's also a particularly turbulent period in everyone's life. And there's so much going on and you're being formulated and there's so many changes happening. So I think it's a particularly interesting time in all of our lives, really.
Why do you think British cinema has got so few kind of teen films? I mean, you can probably count them on your hand and they're quite sort of hard to sort of seek out. You can go back to the 70s or maybe the 60s. There's kind of a couple of sort of Adam Faith movies back in the 60s, or Rock Around the Clock or Summer Holiday. They were Cliff Richards. It's not really been a sort of a great seam that the British cinema has mined.
Yeah, I think perhaps we're kind of now catering a bit more for the teen market. Perhaps since the success of Skins, that now we are more aware that people, that actually, it's a really kind of strong box office comes from teenagers, and with The Tormented and Street Dance 3D's coming out, and I know there's a movie plan for Skins, and I think that perhaps that awareness is growing.
You must have been delighted to see Nicholas Holt, obviously, who was one of your guys from Skins, now blossoming into a fluffy jumper for Tom Ford in The Single Man.
Yeah, no, he's awesome, and he's such a nice boy too, Nick. That he's got a real soft side to him, and he doesn't. It's amazing that a kid that's that good looking is sort of that nice too. It certainly wasn't. The good looking kids at my school weren't like him. Do you know what I mean? He's a really good guy.
You mentioned there's a Skins movie in the offing. Are you involved in that, Jack?
Yeah, I'm writing it, yeah.
Right. What are you going to do with it? Is it the same characters, new characters? You're going to have to cast again? Every time I look at it, it's new people.
Yeah. It's the idea is that it's sort of centred more around Generation 2, but Generation 1 will be involved, and Generation 3 will be in one scene.
That's what they call them. They're like computers these days.
Absolutely.
So Nick Holt might be involved.
If he's available from doing Mad Max or Australia or wherever, you know what I mean?
He's massive.
There is currently a campaign to get him to come back and do a few scenes for us, but, you know, yeah.
It's come quite quickly. I mean, I remember sitting with you for Cubs, and then suddenly here's the scouting book for boys, and I really enjoyed it quite a long time ago, but I tipped you for big things, so you don't disappoint me, Emma.
Thanks, Jason. I'll try.
Good, carry on. What are you doing next?
Directing next thing is working with Jack again on This Is England, the TV series, which is 4 years later.
You're filming that right now, aren't you?
It's the first day of shooting today. Pre-shoot, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
So that's the Shane Meadows This Is England, which starred Thomas Turgoose.
Exactly.
And so it's now 4 years on. They've all moved on. So Thomas can be the age that he is now in your film.
Exactly.
And he's in it again.
Yeah.
And is everyone else back in it as well?
Yeah.
Wow, that's very exciting. Cast,
yeah. It's incredibly exciting. Yeah. We just spent last week, me and Tom, with all the cast in Sheffield.
Which is amazing and quite surreal, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, me and Shane have just been rewriting the scripts madly in the last week, and it's been it's been amazing.
So Shane's really involved in that area of it as well, writing and directing as well.
Yeah, he's doing episodes 3 and 4, and Tom's doing episodes 1 and 2.
That's very exciting, because I was going to say the one person that has kind of delved into the team areas before is Shane Meadows. If you look at 24/7 and then carried on, he's even done Younger with the Room for Romeo Bras, which delved into like the 11-year-old market, which hasn't been done very much before.
Yeah, with Shimmy, who's now in the film too. You know, Shimmy was the 11-year-old. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so they've all kind of, you know,
he's been on the show.
Grown up with them, really.
Yeah,
hasn't
yeah.
Well, just before you go, a mention of the music as well, which I think is very crucial. Has been crucial to Skins. Was crucial to Cubs as well. Tell me about who's involved and how you got them.
So the people who've done the soundtrack are Noah and the Whale, and they were just kind of, they had their first album out at the time that we were making the film. It was just about to, there's a guy at Universal who look after them, and he played me some of their music just before their first album came out, and I really responded to the music and really loved it and wanted to use it in the film, but we didn't really have enough money to pay them properly, so they came and watched a rough cut of the film, and fortunately they liked it and said they'd give it to us for a greatly reduced rate, which is fortunate because I would have been heartbroken.
Because we already cut it to their music.
Yeah, we had, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we would have been absolutely, screwed if they'd.
So Noah and the Whale, the band, have they got an album out? Can we find it?
Yeah, they've been touring a bit recently, actually, and their album's called The First Days of Spring, and they've actually made a film that to go with the entire length of the album, and it's great and really interesting, and Charlie Fink, who made the film, is wicked and really talented, and it's definitely worth checking.
Jack Thorne and Tom Harper, it's been lovely talking to you, lovely to have you on the show, and I hope many more films to come and many more interviews on Film Weekly, but for now, thanks Jack Thorne and Tom Harper.
Thanks very much. Jackson.
Thank you.
And the Scouting Book for Boys opens in the UK this Friday, the 19th of March. Last week on the show, you may recall, we gave you the chance to win a copy of Stieg Larsson's book, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. We got it signed in silver ink by the eponymous leading lady, Noomi Rapace. I asked you what the original title of the book was in Swedish, and many thanks for your answers. They've come flooding in from Glasgow, from New Haven, Connecticut, from Ventura, California, from Washington State, from Madrid and from Glasgow. But the winner that we have picked is Sylvia Greaves from Huddersfield. She knew that the original title in Swedish was Män som hatar kvinnor, which roughly translates as Men Who Hate Women. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is much more cinematic, I must say, and the film is currently packing them in, one of the clear European hits of the year. So, on the way to Leeds Road, Huddersfield, is a copy of Noomi Rapace's tattooed copy of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Congratulations to you. And since we're on a competition vibe, we've got one for you this week as well. It's on a retro tip to go with a new slasher pick, The House of the Devil, out this week. It's a very fine kind of piece of tension with a synthy score and lots of girls with tight jeans and flick-up hair. It's kind of like an old-school John Carpenter movie. She's got a Walkman on, and she's really kind of referencing those 80s slasher movies. The prize itself is an old-school VHS commemorative hard box cover, courtesy of Metrodome Distribution, a real video nasty kind of throwback, this thing. To win it, tell me the name and the date of the official government act that banned video nasties. So that's the name and the date of that act that banned all those video nasties. Answers to film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. Now, shambling through the doors of the studio is a shadowy figure. I think it's Zan Brooks. Zan, what have you been up to this week?
Slouching in to review this week's films.
We're going to look at The Scouting Book for Boys. We're also going to look at EcoDoc, Dirty Oil, and then we'll look at Jim Carrey and Ewan McGregor together in Embrace at Last in I Love You, Philip Morris. Let's start with The Scouting Book for Boys, because we've just had them in Tom Harper and Jack Thorne. What did you think of their first effort as feature filmmakers?
I thought it was a very creditable first feature. It felt a little bit familiar, but that's maybe no bad thing. It's a British social realist coming-of-age drama.
Is that why the familiarity comes in there? Because you think of something like Fish Tank, I suppose. It had a similar
Fish Tank, Rat Catcher, films like that. And it's certainly Fish Tank because it's shot by the same cameraman, Robbie Ryan, who brings that same sun-blenched, woozy atmosphere to it. And that sense of the tawdry glamour of English coastal resorts.
Yeah, exactly, which is not often seen. I mean, we're used to sort of seeing English coastal resorts, I think, in sort of saucy seaside kind of elements, but then we've seen them in recent times in British social realism. They've had that kind of shot of realism, something like the ones that were made in Margate, the Last Resort, from Palakoski. And even though there's a couple of other recent ones in Margate, like Gippo.
Gippo. I kind of like those kind of films. I think that probably British cinema should be making more of them, which sounds like a contradiction because I still found this a little bit familiar. In its rites of passage, young love, hallmarks, it felt that we'd seen it before and we'd seen it a bit better. That's not to take anything away from the actors. Thomas Turgoose, who of course was in This Is England and is a wonderfully pugnacious, stoic, soulful presence here.
How's he growing up? Because obviously in This Is England you think, well, that could be a one-off performance. He's brilliant as Little Sean. And since then he's done Summer's Town. Yeah, a little bit in Eden Lake.
There was Eden Lake, that was it. Him.
I mean, this was the one I thought, this is kind of different to what you've been doing, Thomas. I can see that you're sort of an interesting presence on camera.
Well, it's a good role because it's a role that involves holding a lot back. He's observing the action and you're having to guess his longing that he can barely express that eventually sort of explodes in a great kind of outpouring of emotion. But so it's a tricky role for him to do, and he does it very, very well. You know, he's growing up and he almost looks sort of preternaturally old, doesn't he, Thomas Turgoose? He looks like a sort of 50-year-old man.
It's brilliant when you know someone as a cute little boy and they suddenly go through puberty, yeah. And it's like 4 years when he's only sort of like 19 now or something.
Yeah.
And suddenly that you think, oh my God, they really, I feel like an old uncle or something every time I see him. I was like, haven't you grown? And pinch his cheeks. He probably thinks, oh, you wanker.
He wouldn't like that. And it's got a good performance from Holly Granger as Emily, who's the slightly more vital presence in this duo of these two kids rattling around this caravan park on the Norfolk coast.
Holly!
Get on there. Get on there.
I tell you.
You okay? No, you're not. You're bleeding. Put your tongue out.
Ah!
Tell you what, you could give a maze head with a tongue like that. All you got to do is find a girl to give it to in 24 hours before the swelling drops.
We mentioned it's familiar in British cinema. The trailer park, however, isn't that familiar. It's more familiar from American cinema. And I was thinking of recently things like Frozen River, where they grow up in a trailer park. That aspect, I think, is the little twist on it that gives it a little bit of, I don't know, I suppose it kind of transcends the normal British housing estate because we're a slightly change of locale.
Yeah. I thought the first half was good and I thought the second half was less good. I felt that it slipped towards melodrama and also towards implausibility. You know, the Emily character holes up in a cave up the coastline that the Thomas Turgoose character runs back and forth between. In the meantime, there's this huge manhunt going on. Everyone's involved in scouring every single bit of this landscape. And you think, well, this cave's just over there.
But they don't know. They didn't grow up there. They don't know the place like
come
these
on,
guys.
Come
hey,
on.
Didn't Leonardo DiCaprio hole up in a cave with Patricia Clarkson only last week in Shutter Island? And they live on that. They couldn't find him at all on there's only an island.
That's true.
So, you know, it does happen. Even in the biggest budget films.
It didn't convince me.
That's The Scouting Book for Boys, which I think that the opening is terrific. You know, I'm looking forward to seeing what Jack Thorne and Tom Harper do next. And let's move on to Dirty Oil, an eco-documentary narrated by Canadian-born actress Nev Campbell, because it's about the Albertan tar sands, from which the US now gets most of its oil.
What we are doing is probably the greatest form of moral carelessness you can find on the planet at the moment. We are the new Saudi Arabia.
The extraction of tar sands in Canada releases a very large amount of greenhouse gas, and that has an impact on all of us.
I think it is incumbent upon us, those of us both sides of the aisle, to stand today and to say, this will not stand.
I think for the first time, people realized that there is a pollution delivery system underway here.
Zan, did you know that the US gets most of its oil from Alberta rather than the Middle East, which all these interviewees at the beginning seem to think?
No, I was totally with the interviewees. I assumed the Middle East. I mean, you know, hasn't that been the defining thing of world history
what
for the last...
What we've been fighting for the last 6 years.
And all the while it was coming out of the forests of northern Alberta and not even being mined as such from those forests, but just tar sand where it's just basically ripping off the topsoil of the land and leaving these vast lunar landscapes. I think like they're saying the size of Florida.
Yeah, forests the size of Florida have been wiped away for this kind of, essentially it's like a squeegee process. It seems to be like squeezing the mud and then the oil comes out. Presumably you are outraged by Neve Campbell's revelations.
I kind of knew a little bit about the tar sand exploration, which is one of the sort of the most dirty fuels in terms of its exploration that there is. Of course you're outraged. Of course you're outraged. And this film is wanting you to be outraged. It's a heartfelt, impassioned, tub-thumping documentary. It shows how the Aboriginal people have basically been forced off the land. It shows how the ones who stayed have been seemingly poisoned by the sort of the brown scum that's being poured into the rivers. And the local doctor who blows the whistle on this finds himself sued and kind of run out of town.
I work in a sleepy town of 1,000 people, and the rarest form of cancer, which affects usually 1 in 2 million people. There are about 80 people in this town have got it. I wonder what it could be.
Yeah, exactly. It's full of those kind of horror stories. Within that, it's brilliantly done. It's obviously exhaustively researched.
Yeah, I felt that it could be completely made up.
Did you?
I was one eco doc too far for me. I suddenly became like reactionary kind of, I was like George Bush watching this, going,
sodgy. It's certainly got its agenda. And I think that it occasionally makes some bad missteps. There's some sort of unnecessary Michael Moore-isms in there. There's a bit where you've got the Canadian politician who's defending this policy and saying it's still a beautiful country up here. And then they cut to this spoof tourist brochure advert.
Yeah, that was rubbish.
That was rubbish. I'm sure that they had hundreds of hours of footage that they were compressing down to make this film.
Mercifully into only 73. I didn't like the music. I thought it was uncinematic. I wasn't kind of impressed by the beauty. I was bored by this quaint kind of Indian or First Nation kind of communities that seem to have been wiped out by this, were desperate for the way of life, that they couldn't go bear trapping anymore, which they used to do. I mean, you know, my family don't go shtetl boiling anymore. You know, you've got to move on sometimes.
I kind of agree with that. The idea that tradition is your main argument. They've been doing this for 2,000 years, so let's let them keep doing it. The world doesn't work that way. At the same time, this is a huge crime basically being perpetrated. I wondered about compensation as well. I wondered that felt that maybe they'd glossed over that a bit. Were these people actually paid for being forced off the land? And presumably they were. That's not mentioned. At the same time, I do think we need to see films like this, because I did not know that this was going on to that extent.
Absolutely
up in Canada.
No, I agree with you, and it's a bad thing. And obviously I support kind of nature and beauty and trees, and they are great. There was a better film made about this called Crude
Awakening,
which was about another David and Goliath battle, but this time the Amazonian Peruvian Indians fought back against Texaco. Beat them, saying all the fish were deformed in the Amazon and they couldn't have their lifeblood. I mean, yes, we are polluting our rivers. And that one was much more kind of, go, because there's a little lawyer who kind of schooled himself in law and took them on. I mean, I think all these documentaries would make terrific films, like your doctor, Joseph Connor, The Whistleblower. That would make a really good film, like an Erin Brockovich-type film, the class action kind of element.
This is true, but we're also, there's a lot of these films around and they're starting to kind of blur. I was thinking of Crude Awakening, which has a much more bleak prognosis than
this
one.
Those shots are, again, shots of kind of wasted derricks
and corroded boom towns.
But before these
like
eco-docs, I didn't know that those oil things were called derricks.
Now you do. And so you're learning
something. When I read about decrepit derricks, I thought immediately of Derek Malcolm, and I hope he's well. Let's move on to I Love You, Philip Morris, a new comedy starring Jim Carrey and Ewan McGregor, based on a true story, one I didn't know until the end of this film, about a con artist called Stephen Russell who falls in love with Ewan McGregor, or does he?
I'm Stephen. I used to be a real stand-up guy. I was a good father, a good Christian, and a great husband.
And got to live in the American dream.
Then one day, something wonderful happened.
You might even call it a revelation.
I'm
gay!
Zan, a comedy that played in the director's fortnight in Cannes last year. It has taken all this time to come to our screens. It hasn't done much for in terms of awards for Jim Carrey or Ewan McGregor. And I feel that Jim Carrey kind of took this role on thinking it might be one of those big breakout acting moments for him, like Man on the Moon was.
I think it's a gamble, still a gamble, for a mainstream A-list star to play gay. And from what I've read, I think that this film has run into trouble because of that in America in terms of distribution, that people are just not prepared to go and see a film in which two men might kiss.
Sean Penn, of course, won an Oscar for playing gay in Milk, and I thought he did it rather nicely without all the mincing and kind of shorts and hot pants. Jim Carrey, I'm afraid, is too big an actor to resist the kind of mincing along and wearing kind of, you know, velvet pants.
Yeah, Jim Carrey is a very different kind of performer. He is a natural comic actor, so of course he's going to go for the comedy, which causes problems in this film a little bit, but these problems are nicely counterbalanced by one of the better performances, I think, that Ewan McGregor has given in God knows how many years.
Since Trainspotting, one always has to say.
Since Trainspotting, as Philip Morris, who's the sweet, soulful boy that he meets in jail.
Yeah, so basically the plot is, it's quite twisty and convoluted. It's a con man's plot. I mean, in the end, it was me that ended up feeling conned, actually, by this plot. But just take us through some of the steps, if you can.
Okay, so Jim Carrey plays Stephen Russell, who's a average, God-fearing Christian American cop who is hit by a car and then realises that he needs to come out as gay, tries to support this new lifestyle in Miami, gets thrown into jail, escapes from jail, tries to bust Philip Morris, played by Ewan McGregor, out of jail, and there's frauds and con antics. And
they become very wealthy, don't they?
They become very wealthy.
He becomes, high firm, I don't know quite how.
He becomes some sort of CEO of a corporation by bluffing his way in. I guess it's a freewheeling, screwball farce, but it's a little bit ramshackle and it keeps veering off track.
Did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it.
See, I hated it.
Did you?
I hated it more and more as it went on, more as the mincing, capery kind of took hold, the kind of chihuahua stroking in Miami, the kind of, oh, I'm not really gay, but here I am so gay, I'm so comic, I'm going to do some funny business, I'm still in the mask, I'm Jim Carrey, I'm still Ewan McGregor, I'm still not very good despite all of these roles I've had since Trainspotting. I just didn't believe any of the actual human emotion in it. And I think when you're playing gay, you have to be very kind of careful about it.
I'm not sure you do. I think that's giving it too much reverence. Like, we have to represent the gay community, we have to play this properly and look for the heart of it all. I thought this was brave in that it didn't, and also complex, and maybe unintentionally complex, but I like the fact that Carrey here is playing a very modern American protagonist, where he's somebody who's just defined by actions rather than character. There's a sense of sometimes where you think, I'm not even sure that he is gay. He's fixing on a lifestyle and running for it. And the Philip Morris character is his talisman that he's clinging on to. That is a sort of American thing where you're questing for something and you're almost a hollow man. And I thought that was a kind of interesting aspect of this film.
I'm sure that was the concept of the film. I just don't think that this managed, because it asked you to actually kind of pity them. They're put in jail. You ask you to kind of feel for him in some kind of way. And there was no shred of humanity in the performance at all. He just seemed like someone wanting to kind of do a bit of a gay role. There was a bit where there's a nice, I don't know if he is gay, but there was certainly a bit where he's taking someone very roughly from behind, lit in a kind of oily kind of light.
Yeah.
That looked a bit gay to me.
Yeah, there's certainly some gay antics going in here.
And I don't have a problem with that.
Do
of
you
course.
Not?
No, I don't. But I have a problem with being asked to sympathise with any of the characters involved in it, and I think that was the direction's fault, at the pace of the film,
it's a film that's full of problems. It's made by the same people who wrote Bad Santa, which I think was another film that was almost great and then was flawed and a bit broken, and I think that this is flawed and broken, and it's not quite the film that I wanted it to be, but it did have an energy and an interest.
Zan, that's I Love You, Philip Morris, which you loved rather more than I did. Zan Brooks, thank you very much as ever. You can read all of Zan's musings on film, his features and his reviews and his video reel reviews on guardian.co.uk/film.
Vamos, 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 vamos.
The little island of Cuba has been punching above its weight in the Olympic boxing ring with 32 gold medals in the last 40 years. A new documentary, Sons of Cuba, shows how they've done it, following three young boxing hopefuls through 8 months of grueling training at the Havana Boxing Academy as they build up for the biggest event of their little lives, the Cuban National Under-12s Boxing Championship. During this tumultuous season, however, Fidel Castro fell ill and all of Cuba's Olympic boxing champions defected to the USA, plunging the sport, which so identifies Castro's Cuba, into a deep depression. The film thus gets to the heart of modern Cuba, documenting a moment of historic change from a rare vantage point inside the country. I spoke to the man who infiltrated the boxing academy, Andrew Lang, earlier, and I began by asking him if he was making a film about boxing or a film about Cuba.
I was really interested in the question of how much sacrifice is it worth to go in pursuit of your dreams. And I think that was a question that these kids were having to ask themselves. And I also think it's a question that the whole sort of Cuban revolutionary experience has had to ask itself, you know, in terms of sacrificing every day for something that's going to come tomorrow and not knowing if that tomorrow is ever going to come.
It's true, because the whole fate of that nation, the fabric of that nation, the heart of that nation beats through the hands of these boys. They seem very sort of bound up. One, they're both committed to regimes in a way as well, it strikes me, both physical and political. And I was fascinated by that commitment.
Yeah, absolutely. And at that age, what made them such fascinating characters was that they were still at the age that they hadn't begun to question the ideology and the propaganda they were being fed at school and so on. And that made them very revealing, because the way they spoke was so clearly driven by some kind of brainwashing a lot of the time. And you know, if you were to interview a kid just a couple of years older, the questions would have begun to pop into their heads and the doubts sort of begun to arise. But at that age, they were still very much strong believers.
So tell me about the technical aspect, the ducking and the diving that went on for you to get permission to film in the Havana Boxing Academy, because no one had ever done it before, had they?
That's right. Yeah, it was a really long drawn out process. We shot a trailer back in 2005 secretively, just by passing a bit of money under the table to a couple of coaches. But then to do the proper shoot, which we wanted to shoot over about 7 months, it took us a year to get the permissions. And I actually worked with a completely Cuban crew. I got residency in Cuba myself, and we told the authorities that I wasn't the director, that I was just a sort of observer. And even then, they said that we would have to have a minder with us all the time, which we eventually managed to avoid. So it was very precarious the whole way. And I have to say, I was very relieved when I finally got on the plane with all my rushes intact.
What do you think they were worried about? The fact that the way that Cuba kind of marshals its boxers and trains these kids so that Cuba can have glory in the Olympic ring, that would be unveiled? Or were they scared you would sort of see the kind of, the machinations of propaganda, if you like? Because your film isn't an anti-propagandist film. I think if you were an American documentary maker, A, you probably wouldn't have been allowed in, and B, that might have been your standpoint, but yours is very fair and balanced in that respect.
Yeah, I think we tried extremely hard to make it very balanced, and we tried to not make it didactic. We really wanted the viewers to draw their own conclusions. What they were mainly worried about was just that we would show the poverty, show the fact that kids were living in those kind of conditions, and you know, and they're always scared about someone saying something on camera which is anti-regime. Mm.
Did you find that they were living in terrible conditions? Did you find that there was a lot of poverty, or did you think that this was a nation that is happy in its lot?
No, there's a great deal of poverty, and I think the saddest scene of the whole film is when that kid goes and sees his father, who's a retired Olympic boxer, and the guy's living in a shack virtually.
It's amazing, and there's that poignant sentence. What is it, that sport is just a flickering moment?
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking, and you know, they call him Gloria del Deporte Revolucionario, a glory of revolutionary sport, and he's living like that. So, you imagine that if a superstar is living in that condition, then ordinary people are sometimes living a lot worse.
But that was it. That's the whole question of the film, isn't it? Because my notes when that scene occurred was like, well, why couldn't he turn pro? But of course they don't have pro boxing, I assume, in Cuba. And that's when you get that what comes later, a little coda. And it's not spoiling it too much to sort of say that there's some Cuban champions who defect to the US and are then branded as the ultimate in traitors.
Yeah, professionalism in all sports was outlawed in Cuba in the early 60s. in the early days of the revolution, very few sportsmen defected because they all believed in the revolution. And even into Louis Philippe, the old boxer's era, who you see in the film, none of that generation defected, which was in the 70s. Recently, boxers have started to defect en masse. And actually, when that started was the scene we had in the film. And the reason is simply because they look at people like the guy in the film and they think, I don't want to end up like that. And they get on a speedboat to Miami and try and make it as a professional over there.
And do they?
They've had really mixed fortunes. I actually made a short film for American TV in the summer about some of the defectors, and it was a totally mixed bag. One had become a sort of a superstar called Yuriorkis Gamboa, and another Olympic gold medalist was very down on his luck. So, you know, professional boxing is really cruel, and that applies to even the best boxers like these guys from Cuba.
I think there's that thing with boxing and cinema we were talking about at the beginning. There's some beauty in it. There's such kind of all humanity is there, if you like, in these fights, which is why, you know, the greatest writers have written about them, and Norman Mailer, yeah, and people have made films. Did you have a boxing film in mind? Obviously, one always thinks of behind-the-scenes Cuban documentaries about kind of, you know, unseen talents. One goes back to Buena Vista Social Club. That must have been in your mind in some way.
Yeah, I mean, that film was in my mind, but only in so much as it was such a famous, successful film that we wanted to be very different from it.
Yeah.
You know, we started looking into some of those tracks to use in the film, and it just started sounding and looking like Buena Vista Social Club. And so we went right away with that, right away from that, with the musical choices, and went for sort of hip-hop and Cuban rap.
Yeah, I was going to tell me about some of the music, because it's great. There's even a wonderful sampling of, I don't know if Mark Boland's estate knows about it,
with
some of the Children of the Revolution.
Yeah, and that was a right nightmare, so, as you can imagine. But it was just a mixture of kind of contemporary Cuban hip-hop and some of the music the boys listened to, which gave it that kind of flavour and drive.
So this is the real stuff, this is really what's going on in Cuba right now.
Yeah, I mean, the situation in the film and the music is a kind of real snapshot of what Cuba's like 50 years after the revolution, and the kind of mix of nostalgia and desperation, I guess.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary film that I really enjoyed, as well as found sort of fascinating, compelling, and you got lovely characters in there. I mean, there was a bit of Hoop Dreams, if I kind of, you know, mash up my documentary references, but,
yeah,
you know, one goes back to that as a classic, of course, as a way out. What I couldn't get from the film is where, I suppose it's the balance, as you say, you know, Castro's ill, he's kind of handed over the presidency to his brother, all the kind of nation is watching the television, hanging on every word. What happens when that Castro regime crumbles? What will happen to these kids? What will happen to that nation?
Well, no one really knows, and Cuba's really on a knife edge. It has been since that moment in the film in 2006, where he dramatically ceded power. There's so many different theories, which range from civil war to quiet transition. I think the big change in Cuba will come when Fidel's brother Raul dies, and there are no more Castros left in, or no more leading Castros left in Cuba. Then I think things might open up and start to change quite dramatically. But for the moment, it's just that Cuba has this kind of terrible feeling of being this this country that's wedded to this kind of nostalgia and ideology, but that same nostalgia and ideology is kind of taking it nowhere.
Mm. Except some of these boys will be very well equipped when that regime does change. They'll be boxers. They might be able to have a career as a boxer and actually earn some money, where many of their countrymen might not be. They might be struggling for finance.
Absolutely. And that's one of the ironies, is that there's all these amazing sportsmen come out of Cuba and defect and make their millions as baseball players and boxers and all sorts of other sports. And of course, the reason they're so good is because they've been trained in a socialist sports program. Mm.
It was remarkable to hear people calling each other comrade athlete and things like that. It was become the throwback and the talk about how they didn't have any food when Glasnost happened, and when the fall of the Iron Curtain. That obviously meant that Cuba was starving, of course, and no one was supplying it with any food. A fascinating kind of bit of history, beautifully etched in the ring in Sons of Cuba. Andrew Lang, thank you very much for joining me. You mentioned just before you go that you showed it in Cuba. You obviously had the premiere there, Sons of Cuba. How did it go down in Havana?
Yeah, no, it was an extraordinary experience. We showed it at the film festival. It was really well received, and it's now being distributed in Cuba. It's going to be coming out on 100 screens later on in the year.
Brilliant that a nice British boy like you is involved now in that great tradition of Cuban cinema. Yeah. You must be quite pleased with yourself.
It's quite unusual, quite extraordinary. Yeah, the film won Best Film by a non-Latin American director at the Havana Film Festival, which was quite a coveted prize. And it was a great moment for all my Cuban crew, for whom that film festival is a highlight of the year, to have won that prize.
Well, absolutely. Well, congratulations to you. You can hold your gloves high, Andrew Lang. It's a great boxing film, great film about Cuba as well. Thanks very much for joining me on Film Weekly.
All right, cheers. Bye.
Andrew Lang, who studied at the Cuban Film School, incidentally. His film, Sons of Cuba, is out on Friday, the 19th of March. And that brings me to the end of another show. My thanks to my guests, Andrew Lang, to Jack Thorne and Tom Harper, and of course to Zan Brooks, as ever. Don't forget that competition to win the House of the Devil of Idiom Nasty. Emails to film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. All you've got to do is tell me what was the name of the act and the year that officially banned video nasties. The music we've been using for this week's show is very bouncy, isn't it? Taken from Sons of Cuban, some real Cuban hip-hop. That's what the kids are listening to in Havana. We're down with them, and we're down with the Scouting Book for Boys as well. That's what we're like on Film Weekly. It's how we roll. From me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on this edition, Ian Chambers, goodbye and see you next week. ¶¶